cuidarla.
Let's sit down and open our Bibles at 1 Kings chapter 19. Now, our theme tonight may seem a strange one. It is why God used Elisha. I don't know if you've started in your Bible study to do character studies. They're one of the most profitable ways to earth the great principles of Scripture, or to use another metaphor, to clothe the great things that we've learnt in theory and see them work out in human lives. God, of course, is the same eternally. Human nature is the same eternally. And therefore, the relationship of God with man in the Bible is much the same as the relationship with God and man now. The world has changed, but we haven't changed. So we can learn from these amazing stories. Now, you may ask, why Elisha? Well, that arose in my visit to Japan. One evening, I was having great difficulty in finding a theme for the last evening of a particular Christian convention that I was at. And I think it was the biggest of the conventions that I was at. And one night I worked very late trying to get together a talk for the next day. And I went to bed with nothing. And anybody here who's a speaker will know how worrying that is. And I got up early the next morning, and after praying I worked and worked through to breakfast, and absolutely nothing would come. And as I came back to my room after breakfast, I confess I was a bit worried, and I cast it on the Lord, which I suppose I ought to have done before. And a very clear and strong conviction came into my mind that made me immediately calm. I mean, nothing happened. I didn't hear a voice or anything. But it seemed to me that in my mind there was a clear conviction to use some material that I had on Elisha. Not only the material, but the title flashed into my mind. I'd once read a book called Why God Used the El Moody, a little tiny booklet with 7 reasons why God raised up this American to be a great evangelist. And almost before I could put pen to paper, I thought I'll do 5 reasons why God used Elisha. And it only took me, and this is not normal, I normally have to sweat a long while, it only took me just a few minutes to put all the material down and the heading and know that I'd got the right message for that evening. Now, it was a remarkable thing. This is the only time it happened to me in a very long tour, because that decision was absolutely right. One of the things that I found a little difficult in my tour in Japan was that the leaders wouldn't tell me, or didn't tell me, really what I was expected to talk about. And I suddenly used to find that there was a particular need or theme for the evening, and I hadn't been told. And that evening was the last evening of the convention. It was the climax of the convention. And it was quite clear from everything that was said that a challenge to Christian service was going to be made for young people to show that they were willing to do anything that God might ask of them. Now, supposing my talk had been on prayer or Bible study or temptation, the whole thing would have been completely out of tune. And as it was, I had the theme of Christian service. And it was perfectly fitting for that evening, and I couldn't help thanking God for it, that he prepared me for that evening, because it was unknown to me. Well, since then, I've thought more about that material, and I've cut it down now to 3 reasons that God used the El Moody. So take heart. 7 would have been a bit of a shock, wouldn't it? And you wouldn't have got home before midnight. 5 would have meant you'd had to miss St. Andrews. 3 is just about right, isn't it? Because all sermons ought to have 3 points. So tonight we're going to look at 3 things that God did to prepare and equip this man, or if you like to put it the other way around, 3 responses that Elisha made. I don't really want to put it in human terms only, because Elisha wouldn't have been able to make these responses if God had not done something beforehand. God always takes the initiative. So although I'm going to talk about it in a sense from Elisha's point of view and from your point of view, because I'm going to ask you to make the same 3 responses as Elisha made, in other words, this is going to be a very practical talk tonight, yet of course they're impossible to make if God hasn't moved in our hearts. Before we start, let us not too readily regard Elisha as a lightweight. You know, alongside his great compatriot and predecessor Elijah, we hardly notice him. Elijah's such a giant. But actually, Elisha had a very important ministry in the 9th century, succeeding Elijah. and his call from the time that God actually laid his hand on him, his call and ministry lasted right through 50 years. And the Bible dictionaries tell us that he lasted through the reigns of Ahab, Ahaziah, Jehoram, Jehu, Jehoahaz, Jehoash. It's always quite impossible, isn't it, to tell the difference between many of these kings beginning with J. But at any rate, his ministry lasted through all those particular reigns for 50 years from the time God called him. He was a very young man when he was called. He had a very long and influential ministry. And in fact, there are 18 different episodes concerning his ministry in the Old Testament story, so there's no reason to underrate him. Now, here's the first reason, then, why God used him. And you'll find this in 1 Kings chapter 19. Here it is. It's a very simple reason, but maybe it's worth explaining as clearly as I can again. First, he wholeheartedly consecrated himself to do what God wanted. He wholeheartedly consecrated himself. Now, of course, this all depends upon God giving us an indication of his call and desire for us to serve him. No Christian service originates in human impulse or idealism. We cannot serve God unless he lays his hand on us. This story is a particularly dramatic account of how God laid his hand on this young man. You will find him in verse 19 with the last yoke of oxen, obviously belonging to a fairly well-to-do farmer. He's, I suppose, an equivalent to the rich young ruler in the New Testament. He has, therefore, considerable expectancy of wealth and usefulness in his father's business and so on. And as he's doing this work with the oxen, the figure of Elijah comes across the plowed field, this gaunt, famous figure, I think still rather a terrifying figure to most people, not often seen, comes across the field, takes off his prophetic mantle that he normally wears as a sign of being a prophet, comes across to the young man and the last couple of oxen, throws it over his shoulders and walks off. Now, you can't have a more dramatic call than that, can you? It's impossible to miss what it means because the mantle is the mark of being a prophet. And the reply of Elisha is a very natural one. Verse 20, he says, "Let me kiss my father and my mother, then I'll follow you." I just must go back and talk to them first and tell them what you said and say goodbye. To get what always seems rather a harsh rejoinder from the great prophet, Elijah said to him, "Go back again, for what have I done to you?" Well, it does seem harsh, doesn't it? But I've come to suspect that it was a wise comment. It may be, and I think it probably was, that Elijah couldn't imagine that this young man could follow him. That's nearly always true to human nature, isn't it? But I think what Elijah is really saying is this: look, it's not my call. Don't be swept off your feet by me. If you want to go back and think about it, think about it. If you don't want to come, don't come. This is a matter between God and you. It's not my business. Well, we're suspicious, aren't we, knowing the stories in the Gospels of people who said this kind of thing to Jesus. We rather feel it may be an excuse. What did he do? Did he go back to his parents, and were they able to dissuade him from following Elijah? After all, it wasn't a very enviable thing to follow the great prophet. It was a pretty dangerous job. It wasn't comfortable like being a Church of England clergyman today in this country. No pension fund. Nobody to look after you. No nice church wardens to assist you. Pretty lonely ministry. He returned from following him and took the yoke of oxen and slew them and boiled their flesh with the yokes of the oxen and gave it to the people and they ate. See, he did two things. He called everybody to a feast. Isn't that lovely? He celebrated the fact that he'd been called. He said, "Let's have a party." Didn't go around with a long face. So, Hughes asked me to teach Read, Mark, Learn next term. Oh, that's the one evening of the week gone up the spout that my boyfriend and I always go out and see if we can find a hotter curry than we found last week. Jane, one of my friends, she's giving up the Sunday school and wants me to take her place. The bore. I always enjoy being in church on Sunday morning. And so on. You know, we all feel like this, don't we, when somebody bears down on us and tells us about a job needed at Bethnal Green or in the Sunday School or Reed Mark Learn. But there was no long face of Elisha. It was a joyful privilege. And he called the people together and they had this feast, and if I may put it like this, he burned his plow behind him. As much as to say, I'm not coming back. Now, I like that attitude, don't you? I mean, it really needed some courage. But he saw it as a great privilege and he joyfully went. And there is a sense, I think, in which we can say that Elisha maintained that attitude right through his life. He said farewell to the prospect of wealth and comfort that day, and he maintained that all the way through that 50-year ministry. Now, I am not saying that the really consecrated young man or young woman must leave their ordinary job. So far am I saying that I want you to turn over to 1 Corinthians, keeping a hand in 1 Kings, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 24, where you will learn of a basic New Testament apostolic rule. When the gospel came to many of the communities of Asia Minor, it was so exciting. We learn this from the letters to the Thessalonians, that many young people simply left everything, feeling that Christ was coming and that it wasn't worthwhile being a butcher, a baker, or a candlestick maker. And actually the apostle has to tell them to get back to their work. And he thereby learns to make a rule where he goes to the churches to teach them. And this is one of his rules. We won't go into the whole context, which shows you the kind of way in which he worked this out in practice. But here's the rule in verse 24. Brothers, in whatever state each was called, there let him remain with God. Called meaning, of course, called to salvation. Now, it is actually from that chapter and that verse that the whole notion of vocation has come into the English language and Western culture. Pretty interesting that, isn't it? The whole idea of a vocation in your job comes from that, because the only vocation the New Testament knows is the calling to follow Jesus Christ. But you see what happens. If I follow Jesus Christ, I'm to stay where I am and follow him there and make, therefore, the work I'm doing a calling, part of my calling to follow Jesus Christ. But it's an interesting rule, isn't it? It's my rule in all the churches, he says, elsewhere in that chapter. That's what he calls upon people to do. Where does it say it's his rule in all the churches, Dick Lucas? Verse 17, Hugh, as usual, knows his Bible well. Only let everyone lead the life which the Lord has assigned to him and which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. So I hope that's absolutely plain. It's only a very small minority of people who actually come out of their ordinary everyday work to be full-time workers for God. But I think the principle is the same for everybody. I don't think there's meant to be two classes of Christians. Any of you who are doing Read, Mark, Learn will remember that Jesus calls the disciples and calls them to leave their work. Now, they had to leave it to follow him to be disciples. But in principle, it is the same for all of us. That is that when we follow Jesus Christ, the world no longer rules our lives. We sit loose to the loyalties and claims of this world. Turn to 2 Kings chapter 5. Elisha, as I say, almost certainly came from a wealthy family, but he never became a wealthy man. And some of you will remember the day when Naaman, the great general of Syria, was converted, and as a sign of his gratitude, he came back to the prophet Elisha and asked him to accept a present. He does that in 2 Kings 5:15. Behold, I know there is no God in all the earth but in Israel, so accept now a present from your servant, and you can be pretty sure that it was a generous present. We know from the rest of the story that he had a lot of wealth in his trailer behind the car. And verse 16, Elisha says, as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will receive none. And Naaman urged him, and he refused. Obviously. Why? Not because he was discourteous, but because it had to be made abundantly plain that you couldn't buy God's blessings and that money was not in it. And if you know anything about other parts of the world, India, for example, you will know that the hand is always out in every religion. It has to be paid for. But in the Bible, it is quite clear we don't work that way. Freely we receive, freely give. And Elisha had to give freely as a sign that God gives freely, and so he refused it. And many of you remember that Elisha's servant had quite another idea. And verse 20, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, said, "My master is an idiot. He spared him. What a silly thing to do. I'll run after." And we won't go into the whole shaming story, but it always proves to me that you don't have to take any course in being evil. We all know how to do it straight away. He was the most adept liar and thief, this man. And having done it and put away all this marvelous wealth, verse 25, he went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said to him, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" "Oh, your servant went nowhere." Well, schoolboy stuff, this, isn't it? It reminds me of the French mistress when I was a small boy. You know, boys would disappear for hours from her classroom and then suddenly reappear. "Where have you been?" "Oh, I've been here all the time, mademoiselle." Of course, they hadn't. They'd been all over the school and the classroom. Small boys behave like that. Gehazi behaved like that. Innocent look. I've been here all the time. Doing my old jobs, you know, copying out your sermons. Fixing up train times. Verse 26. But Elisha said to him, "Did I not go with you in spirit when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Was it a time to accept money and garments, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, manservants and maidservants?" You see, what you learn about Gehazi, who always in this story turns out to be a very inadequate person, is that his heart is in the world. He's in Christian service, but he's dreaming about retirement. Olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, men servants and maid servants. His heart is in the world. I think that's the issue, isn't it? Where does your heart lie? And Satan all your life will try to wean you back to put your heart in the world. I'm not saying there's anything wrong in the good things of the world. God gives them to us freely to enjoy. Nevertheless, I've got to be willing to follow Christ wherever he calls me. Hugh made an interesting comment in his sermon this morning. Some of you may have heard it. He said that when he was coming to St. Helens, certain people said they were sorry to hear that he was coming to St. Helens because this was a place of privilege, as though he ought to have been going to a poor place. Well, it's good to be challenged like that, isn't it? Because unless Hugh was willing to go to Timbuktu or wherever it was, then he can't accept the call to come here. It's no good saying to God, "I will go in certain areas and I won't go in others." You've got to be willing to do what he asks you to do, and then he will tell you what he wants. I've got to be willing to go to the ends of the earth, and then he may tell me to witness to my neighbor next door. We're all idealistic, aren't we? At the age of 11, before I was regenerate, I was very wicked at the age of 11, I said to God, I went to a crusader class, so I knew the jargon. I said to God, "I'll go to Japan and be a missionary." And that was my ambition as a small boy. So when I went to Japan this time, my second visit, I thought to myself, "Lord, did I fail you? Was that really your original intention for my life?" And I had a most interesting experience, really, as I thought about it over many weeks. I saw quite clearly that I could be of some help in a short visit like that, but that I was quite unsuited to be a missionary. Now, you say it's very convenient to see that. But actually, I met at a supper, a Japanese supper, where we sat on the floor and had the most delicious food imaginable. Actually, though, I didn't quite manage the raw fish and the seaweed, but it was delicious. But into that supper, where there were entirely Japanese people and myself, there slipped in a man who was at Cambridge with me. And he's been a missionary there for 30 years, and he hopes to do another 10 years. That's his aim, 40 years. I got to know him very well just in those few days that I met him and we talked together, and I saw how perfectly, in language, in temperament, in his family, he was suited to it, and how perfectly unsuited I was. And I said, "Lord, I'm so grateful that you accepted the will of a small boy to serve you, but I'm so thankful you didn't accept my idea of where I would be any use." Because we see ourselves quite wrongly nearly all the time, don't we? We think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think, nearly always. All that is asked of us is that we should joyfully be willing to do what we're asked. And my friends, it is no sacrifice to be asked to go to Japan as a missionary or anywhere else. From this remarkable volume on Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, to speak of any... I'm sorry, let me go a little earlier. He was a young man, a brilliant doctor in Harley Street, gave it all up to go to be a pastor in a small, rather scruffy church in South Wales. People were very interested. The newspapers reported the change of career. It was easy to emphasize the unusual, to speak of the great sacrifice he had made in leaving medicine, but he disliked such language intensely. To speak of any loss in the context of being a Christian amounted in his eyes to a denial of the gospel. He never forgot the shock of once hearing a man say, "I've been a Christian for 20 years and have not regretted it." Further, his view of preaching was such that to talk of sacrifice in relation to that work was virtually absurd. There could be no higher privilege than that of being a messenger of the God who has pledged his help and presence to those whom he sends. When, as it happened at times, people referred in admiring terms to his self-denial in entering the ministry, he repudiated the intended compliment completely. "I gave up nothing," he said on one such occasion. "I received everything. I count it the highest honor that God can confer on any man to call him to be a herald of the gospel." That's said by a man who could have probably got a title, enormous amount of money. He was a brilliant diagnostician. And went, and I don't know what he lived on, 200 or 300 a year down in South Wales in the Depression. "I received everything, I gave up nothing." That's what Elisha said. "I count it the highest honor that God can confer on any man to call him to be a herald of the gospel." Therefore, I want you to say in your heart, if you're a Christian, you can't say it if you're not a Christian, I want you to say in your heart these words as I say them. "I'll go where you want me to go. I'll do what you want me to do. I'll be what you want me to be." And in saying those words with me, you're not a hero. You're just a fool if you don't. Because God's will for all our lives must be the best. But I know the stubbornness of my heart, and the stubbornness no doubt is there in yours, that we always think we know better. We cling on to absurd things rather than willingly opening our hearts to God, whatever he says. There's a very, very corny old story. I'm not sure whether it was an original one with Billy Graham or goes back long before him, and I won't tell the story with the drama that he can tell it, of a child that had its arm caught in a vase, and it was impossible to get this vase off the child's wrist. They pulled and tugged and couldn't. Finally, they had to break it. It was a very precious vase, apparently, so the story goes. Completely apocryphal, but it makes the point. So they bust the vase, and what did they find? They found a small boy clinging on to a pebble. Now, if he just let his hand go like that, they could have pulled the vase off quite easily. But that's very characteristic of us, isn't it? We will cling on to the most absurd things rather than let God have his way, and therefore break and spoil some of his purposes for us. There are the three sentences. Just think about them before we go on. Let me read them again. You might like to echo them in your heart, though I shouldn't do that until you've had time to think about it. I might talk about them at St. Andrew's. "I'll go where you want me to go. I'll do what you want me to do." Might be something very practical tomorrow. "I'll be what you want me to be." And when Elisha was called upon to do something really quite frightening, he called his work people together and had a feast and burnt his plough before him, behind him, as much as to say, "What a privilege to do what God wants me to do." He willingly consecrated himself to do God's will. That's the first reason why God used Elisha for 50 years. Secondly, these are so simple, you know, they're almost too simple to mention, but I think they need saying. They're in the Bible. Secondly, he willingly persevered through a long apprenticeship. Look at verse 21 of 1 Kings 19. It says at the end of the chapter that he arose and went after Elijah and ministered to him. Now turn over to 2 Kings chapter 3 verse 11. 2 Kings chapter 3 verse 11. Jehoshaphat said, "Is there no prophet of the Lord here, though, through whom we may inquire of the Lord?" Then one of the king of Israel's servants answered, "Elisha the son of Shaphat is here. He is the man who poured water on the hands of Elijah." Now, I imagine that that was a conventional way of talking about someone's servant, but I think you will agree with me that even though it is conventional language, it is very down to earth, isn't it? Is it not he who carried Elijah's books? Not he who wrote Elijah's sermons, but he who poured water over his hands. That is, he did the menial tasks of a valet, an assistant, a personal assistant. Now, I can't quite work it out, but some commentators say that he did this for 18 years. It was a long time. If so, it is a really remarkable thing, isn't it, that for 18 of the 50 years, he was learning and preparing and being trained. Now, I read this passage and spoke on this in Japan, and I knew when I was speaking on it that it was very relevant in Japan because they have an ancient culture, a very remarkable culture, actually. There are many things that are most enviable. For example, their good manners to one another. But one of the things in their culture, as many of you will know, is that age is greatly honored and that people don't retire from committees. And therefore, the chairman of the committee of the main convention where I was speaking out on this occasion was in his 90s and was actually in hospital dying. And the next chairman would be the oldest member of the committee. And there were two vice chairmen, both of whom must have retired, both most godly men, I hasten to say, but both of them must have retired from their churches 15 years ago. Now, of course, they couldn't run the thing. The thing was run by what I call the younger pastors, and the very able men they were. When I say younger, they were men with grown-up children, men in their late 40s and early 50s. But although, do you see, these men were running it, they were not leading the committee. Because in that culture, you have to wait for a very, very long time before you're allowed to have your hand, so to speak, on the tiller. Now, that can be very frustrating. It means that men of 50, of great ability, have been trained, many of them are trained in America and so on, many of them with learned degrees and great experience, still are not the people who call the shots. Yes, it sometimes is a very, very frustrating thing to have to wait to get into other people's shoes, and it must have been for Elisha. I want you to see, however, what he says about him when Elijah goes to heaven after that long walk that we read of this morning in church. We did this whole second chapter of 2 Kings when they walked together round all the theological colleges before finally Elijah goes to heaven. And you'll see in verse 11, as they still went on and talked, 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 11, "Behold, a chariot of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it and cried, 'Good riddance. At last. Now I can get my hands on things.'" Which would have been very natural. But what does he say? He says, "My father, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen." In other words, you're worth more than several divisions to this country. You're the real defense of our people. What we're going to do with you, without you, we cannot imagine. You're our strength. Now you see, that I think is remarkable. Here is a man who might have found it very trying to flesh and blood to have a dramatic call. You know, to go back to your parents. Your parents say, "Well, what are you going to do?" "Oh, I'm going to be a prophet." "Oh, that's wonderful. We'll be able to tell our friends you're going to be the prophet." And year after year, goes wrong. "What's your son doing, by the way?" "Well, he's Elijah's servant." "Well, what does he do?" "Oh, well, he takes him his morning cup of tea." "Do you mean your son doesn't do anything more important than that?" "Oh, well, he is going to be the prophet one day." "Well, when?" "When indeed." A long, long apprenticeship. Now, there is, I think, a lesson here. You see, there are two qualities that are needed in the Christian worker. One is zeal and boldness, and the other is wisdom and discretion. When we're first converted to Christ, it isn't very difficult to have that boldness and zeal. Indeed, it's one of the lovely marks of the young Christian. But the young Christian often has boldness without wisdom. Alas, the older Christian often has wisdom without boldness. God is looking for both. But you do have to wait to get that wisdom and discretion. Do you remember Mark's failure? Some of you reading Mark Lern must have followed it. Do you remember in Acts 15 when this very privileged young man, whose mother had a house in Jerusalem, who must have spoken to all the great leaders of the early church. You remember that he went with Paul and Barnabas, and Paul and Barnabas had really a very big family row about it. Paul said, I'm not going to take him because he failed us so badly before. It was really one of the most unpleasant rows in the early missionary journeys of Paul. And Mark is left behind. And then very, very much later, in Paul's last letter, 2 Timothy chapter 4, don't bother to look it up, he says in his loneliness, I want you to bring Mark with you, for he is very useful to me in the ministry. Now, I think that's a very moving statement. It means that between those two times, Mark had learnt to be a servant. And I'm sure he'd learned to be a servant partly by writing his gospel, partly by poring over and studying the stories of Jesus, the great servant. And you will know, if you're reading and studying Mark and read Mark Learn, that one of the emphases in Mark's gospel is how Jesus trained the disciples, and what a long and painful business it was. 3 long years, it seemed they would never learn. Kept saying, how dull you are. Don't you understand? Don't you remember? Can't you see it? Lord, the other disciples are just off for a moment, and James and I wanted to have a talk with you. We wondered if when you come to your throne in Jerusalem and are made king, well, we wouldn't, of course, have said this ourselves, but our mother has suggested we say it to you. She's keen for us to get on and looks at us perhaps through rose-colored spectacles, but she's probably right. And we wondered if we could sit on your right hand and on your left. It's very painful, isn't it? How they must blush in heaven to know that we're talking about it at St. Helens on a Sunday night. Would you like it? Would you like all those sort of painful things of your early Christian life to be talked about for 2,000 years? Oh, you just want to decently cover them up, don't you? At least I do. I don't even look at some of those painful things in my life myself, you know. When my memory goes to them, I just turn away from them, don't you? Yes, it takes a long time to make us of any use. A strong Christian home background is a tremendous privilege. You know, God normally uses that to turn out Christian leaders, because Christian leadership can need a great deal of resilience and strength. And it's true that people converted later on in life probably won't have those foundations. So that if God has given you a good Christian background, then he's already started to prepare you. I mean, in Sir Michael Redgrave's obituary this week, it said how he was brought up in a theatrical family. You know, he's just brought up to think about it, to hear about it all the time. Just like being brought up in a doctor's family. Another way to learn and to pick up quickly, if you started later, is to read Christian biography. I've just pulled some out on, I think it's the second shelf down, some of Isabel Kuhn's books. Every Christian girl in this church ought to read Isabel Kuhn, and every Christian man too. I think they're some of the finest books on Christian training. What a remarkable missionary she was. And there are many other biographies there. C.T. Studd. And many others where we can learn a lot about how God makes a leader. We need not to be taken in, don't we, by our instant culture. You don't make a missionary in Japan inside 8 years. To learn that language is a long business. You don't make a youth worker in a day. To learn to be a youth worker is quite a long business. I was, sometimes when I want to go to bed with a smile on my face, I pick up Malcolm Muggeridge. Do you read Malcolm Muggeridge ever? I think he's probably a figure that people don't know so well today, but in the 70s, he was very powerful on television. Some of you may remember him. Demolishing humanism and materialism and Marxism. He wrote 2 volumes of autobiography. Everybody's waiting for the 3rd one. He's now in his 80s. I don't know if he'll ever write it. But the 2 volumes, finish at the end of his pagan life. And it finishes, volume 2, there was a new way to be discovered, and he became a Christian, a rather eccentric Christian, but a Christian. Well, we're all longing to vol. 3 to tell us how it all happened. But you know, those first 2 volumes, right up to when he was what, 60 years of age? What a long preparation, all those years following false trails as a journalist. Brilliant man, going up the false trails again and again. There's nobody in the 1970s who could demolish the alternatives to Christianity like that man, because God had trained him for 50 years to see the hollowness of the alternatives to Christianity. But God isn't in quite the hurry we are. I'm not suggesting it'll be 50 years before you start your work. Some of you already started. I hope you started directly and became a Christian. But don't be impatient at training, and don't be impatient when people rebuke you because you make mistakes, or when your conscience rebukes you. Don't give up because you make a failure. If you've had a failure as a Sunday school teacher or whatever it may be, don't take it too hard and despair. It's all part of this wonderful training. Follow me, I will make you fishers of men. Isn't that a lovely promise? And he said it to people of considerably tough material. I will make you. And he says it to you, I'll make you. So the second reason I think that God used Elisha is that he willingly accepted a long apprenticeship and was loyal and obedient and humble in those long years of service. Now here's the third reason why God used him. And perhaps this is the dramatic one. He boldly trusted God to make him adequate for the job he had to do, though he felt completely inadequate. He boldly trusted God. Now, I want you to see this in 2 Kings 2. I don't think there's much doubt that Elijah had many doubts about Elisha. We can't tell for sure, but it looks like it. It also looks as though the theological students they visited on that last walk also had a pretty poor view of Elisha. Now that again is only normal to life. If you've got a giant like Elijah, everybody looks at the giant and nobody looks at the other people. So as they went round the theological colleges on a last visit, the students came out and they said to Elisha, "You know, God's going to take him away. That'll be the end of you. The only reason you're of any importance is because you just bask in his glory." Or whether that was in their minds, it seems to suggest it, that they didn't think very much of him. And he comes on that last journey, and he says to his elder brother, verse 9, or rather Elijah says to him, "Ask what I shall do for you before I'm taken from you." And Elisha says, "I pray you let me inherit a double share of your spirit." He had this tremendous desire for the fullness of God's spirit, the best that God could make him. And Elijah says, "You asked a hard thing, but if you see me as I'm being taken from you, it shall be so for you. If you don't see me, it shall not be so," and so on. Now you see, unlike James and John, he doesn't ask for this great position. He knows that God has given him that. He asks for the capacity to use it to serve men. He cries to God, in effect, by asking Elijah that he may have the fullness and equipment of the Holy Spirit. He wants the best that God will give him. He has an intense desire for it. I do pray that you've got that desire. Now, it's a wonderful thing when we're converted that God turns us upside down or the right way up. Before we're converted, we're completely contented, aren't we, spiritually? You have noticed that about your friends? They're quite contented. Can't think why you're trying to worry them. But we're all discontented materially, aren't we, by nature? Never have enough. Right. When God turns us upside down by the Holy Spirit at our conversion, what happens? We become much more contented materially, but we become much more discontented spiritually. We begin to want more. We begin to be ambitious that God shall use us. That's right. Now verse 15, "When the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho saw him over against them, they said, 'The spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha.'" We'll see that story in a minute. "And they came to Elisha and bowed to the ground before him, and they said, 'Behold, now there are 50 men here. Please, may we go and seek your master. The spirit of the Lord has caught him up, but he's obviously put him in some mountain or valley, and we need him. May we go and find him?'" You see, Elijah was that kind of man. He suddenly disappeared and suddenly reappeared. It never occurred to them that Elijah had gone for good. Of course not. God wouldn't leave Israel without Elijah. He'd just been cast into some valley. They must go and find him, help him back again. And Elisha says, "Don't do that." But they urged him, verse 17, till he was ashamed. And he said, "Send." They therefore sent. And for 3 days they sought him, but they didn't find him. They came back And Elisha said to them, did I not say to you, don't go? Now, you see the point? Elisha knew that Elijah wasn't coming back, but they couldn't accept that. And you will find that we Christians who are getting older are always sighing for the past. You know, the giants of yore. We talk about the great loss the church has had because they've died, and it's quite right. There is a great loss. But we somehow get completely caught up in that. Now, I think there's a tremendous lesson here. When Elisha sees Elijah go up to heaven, do you see verse 13? He took up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him, and he went back and stood on the bank of Jordan. And he took the mantle of Elijah and struck the water and said, now what did he say? Lord, where's Elijah? Can't get on without him. Please tell me where he is. No, he says, where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? Where is the God of Elijah? He's alive. And if he is alive, we can continue. Now, this will tell you whether your trust is in man or God. The attitude you get is that the great days were in the past and we're never likely to see them again. And that everybody today is a pygmy. So we must read the writings of the past because there's nothing today worth reading. Is that really the right attitude? Oh, we should certainly read the great writings of the past. We should certainly read of the great stalwarts of the past. Christian biography is one of the most profitable of all reading. We should certainly read their sermons and what they said. The reformers still have a lot to say to us from the 16th century. Wesley, Whitfield from the 18th century. Spurgeon from the 19th century. But are we living in the 19th century? I don't think we are. And I think the remarkable thing about Elisha is that he realized that. And he was the only person who did realize it. And he was willing, though he knew himself to be totally inadequate, to look up to God and say, you call me to do what Elijah did, and I've taken his mantle and I'm going to strike the waters as he did, and I'm going to trust you. If I may use the psycho jargon of today, he believed in himself. I don't like that phrase. But there is a sense in which we do have to come to believe in ourselves and believe that God can make us adequate for the task of today. But God can only make us adequate for the task of today if we get our eyes off ourselves to God. Because if we have our eyes on ourselves, we'll never face the challenge of today. Because we are pygmies. We are inadequate. We live in a man-centered world, don't we, in the 20th century? Everything is man-centered, including the psychology. Everything. Sociology, the lot. Politics. And theology, too. If you keep your eyes on one another, if you spend your whole time going to be counseled by people, you will never be adequate for today. We're pathetically inward-looking, aren't we? We're always examining ourselves. What we've got to do is to have the courage to look to God and believe that God can make us equal to the needs of today. And if we don't do that, there is no hope for our country and our church. The fact is that Elisha could never be like his predecessor. He was not intended to be. Do you think that there were some people who copied Elijah? I'm quite sure there were. I'm quite sure there were people who gave Elisha the advice to dress like Elijah and to use his mannerisms. Of Dr. Sung, the great Chinese evangelist, perhaps the greatest evangelist Southeast Asia has ever known in the 30s and 40s, it says that he left a few disciples wherever he went. Afterwards, they went out as freelance evangelists to preach on their own, imitating Dr. Sung's every pose, especially that of putting one foot forward, the heel resting on the floor, and the sole of the shoe showing forward. For a time, there would be many would-be imitators of Dr. Sung's methods, even his mannerisms, but they soon found that they lacked his power, without which the manner was useless. That's a good comment, isn't it? Absolutely useless to copy the past. It's ridiculous to try to be like the heroes of the past. We're not called to be. We're called to be the person that God has made us to be today, and it'll take a great deal of courage to believe that God can actually use us today, and most people will not feel that we're up to it. And if we try to copy the 19th or the early 20th century, we shall only make fools of ourselves. For not only had Elijah gone, times had changed. A new generation had sprung up. Vast, sweeping changes in Japan today. It's no good going back even 20 years in Japan. A new generation of leaders is needed to face the new world. Let's finish the story by turning to 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 14. Elisha, completely different from Elijah, living in a completely different and new era. But he did his own work, just as Elijah did his. And they were able to do it in their different ways because they had the same God. And when this much more ordinary person, Elisha, died, fell sick with the illness with which he was to die, verse 14 of 2 Kings 13. By the way, isn't that interesting? You see, they were different even in that. Don't you think that some people said, if Elisha isn't taken to heaven in a whirlwind, he can't be the same man as Elijah? Those sort of things are so foolish, but they're very hurtful, aren't they? Elijah was swept to heaven with a whirlwind. Elisha died in the normal way. And Jehoash, the king of Israel, went down to him and wept before him. And Jehoash was a pretty miserable lot, as you know. But nevertheless, Jehoash, even though not a particularly good man, recognized a great prophet, and he wept before him, and he cried, "My father, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen." Exactly the same obituary as Elijah.